The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So here we are, almost exactly in the middle of our coming and going sesshin. There's a strange thing that happens with time during any retreat or sesshin, or actually life, where getting to the middle seems to take forever, and then coming to the end vanishes in the snap of a finger. And this is what I've noticed again and again and again at retreats, at sesshin. And probably, maybe that's happening for some of us too. Although one of the beauties of the coming and going sesshin is that our beginning and our end is always different. So in that way, it's a little bit like ordinary human mortality. People are born and people die, and they enter the stage, they leave the stage, and we don't know what our ending is going to be. So even though we talk about middles of things, it's not exactly accurate. But anyway, we count days, and this is the middle. And last night, we're beginning to talk about the fifth of the seven points of Lojong training: assess and extend. And I talked about the first slogan, there's only one point. So there's only one point refers to the deep truth that's present in all Buddhist teachings, that everything revolves around, that there is no permanent self that is separate from anything else in the universe. Anything else anywhere is part of this great matter that resonates and fills the universe, and sometimes it looks like you, and sometimes it looks like me, and sometimes like a raccoon or like a rice cooker. And so these things are constantly shifting and changing, but we do tend to create a sense of I, of me and mine. And the Buddha said, and the Lojong teachings point to the importance of seeing through that particular delusion, which we can't do intellectually. We can only point to it, which is what I tried to do last night. And then in the wonderful way that these slogans twist and turn and curve, the next slogan, according to Norman Fisher's translation, is trust your own eyes. Well, that's great, because we just said there is no you. So how could you trust someone who doesn't exist? And this is the great thing, because, of course, if we go into the feeling of I am nothing, then we get caught in emptiness, in the absolute. Things are not the way they are. Things, as one sutra said, are not as they appear. And then the second clause of that line is, nor are they otherwise. Because there is always the world of form. Things are and are not. And at a certain point in our practice, these things come together, merge together as one experience, which we call awakening. So awakening is sometimes awakening to the world of emptiness from the world of form. But in my mind, the integration of emptiness and form is where the rubber meets the road. This is where we get to really be people of the way. And this kind of integration takes forever. It takes all of our lives. Because we keep swinging back and forth from, in this case, me to no me, or from form to emptiness, or from the relative to the absolute. And so the Lojong teachings, which talk very clearly about absolute and relative, are always telling us how to integrate, because if we swing too far in one direction, they will swing us back. And that's what this next slogan does. And the overarching theme of this fifth point is assessing and extending, that is, checking out how is practice going, and then applying it. How can I extend it out to every particle of my life. This is what we have to engage in, because if we just, we always say, and I heard this from my first teacher, and I think you've heard it from us, that you can't judge your own practice. We were talking about this just the other way. And you can. This is the swinging back and forth. You know, we know, there's something we know when we've kind of hit the groove, when we have allowed our empty boat, as Pema Chodron talks about, to hit the current of the water and be carried. There is a certain feeling that we recognize when that happens. We stop trying to make everything such a huge effort. And it's a sweet thing, and usually when that starts to happen, for most of us, we go, oh, this must be what they're talking about. How can I do this again? And then we get lost in efforting. On and on and on. The swing, the back and forth, the circling around the great matter, which is just one thing, always. So trusting your own eyes, which is how Norman Fisher puts it, means something very particular in this practice. It can easily get confused. All these points for me in, well, I guess all of them, but especially in point five, as I've been looking into this myself, are very subtle, because it's very easy to hear them and hear them as kind of instructions that are very clear. You know, okay, so there is no self, so just get down with that. And then, no, there is a self and you should trust it, so just get down with that. So of course, neither one of those are exactly true. There's so much delicacy and tenderness and subtlety in all of these teachings. So trust your own eyes is very important. And what this means is, if we're trusting ourselves, trusting our sense of things, trusting that feeling of being in alignment with the way things are, it's not something that we can then say, ah, yes, I have now learned how to trust myself. Because, frankly, at least in my life, I trust myself and then I feel like I really don't understand anything at all and just fall apart in self-doubt and self-recrimination, which I think is the big swing that this one stands in the middle of. The super sure, I know everything, I'm in charge of the universe, let me tell you the way things are, you should listen to me because I am the utmost expert on everything. And then the swing back to, oh my gosh, I have no idea, I'm just a wreck, nobody should listen to me, I'm a sorry excuse for being a human being. This morning in our officers' meeting, we realized that, at least before some of you showed up today, we didn't have a lot of people who knew how to ring the bell or play any of the instruments, and, you know, we're training in that. And David and I said, oh, we really like to do it. I really like to play instruments. And Ray, our chant leader, gave me what I wanted. And then there was the bell in front of me, and my first thought was, oh, no. Oh, I'm going to be exposed. I teach other people how to play the bell, and now I'm going to just screw it up royally, and everyone will see through me, and what a mess I am. Thankfully, I don't think that happened. But really, thankfully, I don't know. I remember I did miss one little bell and got it just in time. But that's not the point, right? This is not about showing up. That's the swing into I know everything. And the other swing is where I saw the bell and went, uh-oh. But it's somewhere in between. And luckily for me, I played the bell enough times that I was able to get right to the business of playing the bell and not getting disturbed by all my thoughts about knowing everything about it or not knowing anything about it. Just that beautiful little balance where it was just the bell, and it played, and I participated in the playing of it. Then even that sounds too much. I don't want you to think that I'm some perfected being that just drops everything and becomes one with the striker and the bell sound and blah, blah, blah. No, it's not like that. But moving in and out of ease, and then, turning a page, uh-oh, and then back, and uh-oh, and back. So it's kind of like this. So the trusting yourself, trusting your own eyes, trusting your own view of things that Norman Fisher talks about, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche says, of the two witnesses hold the principal one. That's his translation. So the two witnesses are my view of things and the views of others. And he says, and the Lojong teachings point us to, Norman Fisher talks about this as well, that the principal witness, the principal witnesser, the principal being who perceives the world is coming from here, coming from this internal sense of things. And we do get feedback from the outside world, you know, as a person who's in a position of authority. I get lots and lots of feedback. Some of it is wonderful. You know, you're the most amazing person on the planet. I owe my life to you. And somehow that doesn't get through to me. so don't bother. Boy, you know, you are a sorry excuse for a human being. I don't know how you can possibly live with yourself. Goes right in. And there you have it. Because human being stuff. You know, praise and blame. This is what happens. So praise and blame are the two swings of the pendulum. Again, it's not about praise. It's not about blame. It's not about knowing more than everybody else or knowing nothing. It's finding that balance point where both of those things come together. So I wanted to read you a koan and maybe even tell a story from our koan tradition to illustrate some of this, because from my point of view, hanging out with the Tibetan teachings, it gets a little bit much. My home base, the place where I feel the most alignment, is with our Zen practice. And koan practice is one of my favorite ways to practice. And I have to include breath practice and shikantaza. So those are our three practices, and I love those. Lojong is a stretch for me, and I like to be stretched. So here we are giving talks about Lojong. But I'm going to read you a koan that I think talks a little bit about this, and then tell you a story that's part of the background of this koan, which I think talks about it even more. It's one of these very bittersweet stories that I think sets everything up. So this is case 44 in the Blue Cliff record, and it's called Hoshan Beats the Drum. So Hoshan said, learning by study is called hearing. I'm actually going to pause throughout this koan to say a few things about the koan. Maybe I'll read the... No, I think I'll do what I was going to do first. And there you have it. Oh, my goodness. Just everything's a mirror for everything, isn't it? So can I trust myself to pause because that's what I thought was a good idea? Or should I... The little puppets in the mind are having a little battle right as we are in the middle of listening to this Dharma talk. It's pretty cool to be a human being with this capacity to get in our own way. So Hoshan said, learning by study is called hearing. So in the terms of the Lojong teaching, this is a pointer to receiving things from the outside. So learning by study, or receiving feedback, or reading about Lojong, or reading about koans, or about Zen. This is called hearing. And we might say this is called receiving. And then he says, learning no more. We might say the end of learning. Learning no more is called nearness. So this is where things fall away and everything, another word that's sometimes used here is intimate. Nearness. That interbeing that I was talking about last night. Everything combined together to be just this. Learning no more is called nearness. Transcending these two is true passing. So you can hear the echoes of the teaching in this this fellow who lived in the 10th century, maybe right around the time that Atisha was formulating the slogans, the Indian teacher Atisha, who transmitted them to people in Tibet, and now we are receiving them, simultaneously understanding some of these things. Learning by study is called hearing. Learning no more is called nearness. And this nearness, this is the reliable, the eyes, trusting our own eyes of the two witnesses. And then transcending these two, transcending in the sense of bringing it all together, no longer swinging back and forth. This is true passing. So a monk stepped forward, as monks tend to do, and said, "What is true passing?" And Hoshan said, "I know how to beat the drum." The monk persisted. You gotta love this monk. We don't know his name, but he has a big role in this story. The monk asked again, "Okay." He doesn't say that here in the translation, but I think of him saying that. "Okay, all right. So what is the true teaching of the Buddha?" And Hoshan said, "I know how to beat the drum." And the monk asked again, "I'm not going to ask you about this very mind as the Buddha, but what about no mind, no Buddha?" These are two very famous teachings from an ancestor of these folks and our ancestor, Matsu, who said at one point in answering what is Buddha, "This very mind is the Buddha," and another time said, "There is no mind, there is no Buddha." So again, you hear the swing between relative, "This very mind is the Buddha," and then "no mind, no Buddha," the absolute. So this persistent monk says, "I'm not asking you about this very mind is the Buddha. That is, I'm not asking you about beating drums. I'm not asking you about the particular, relative. What about no mind, no Buddha?" And Hoshan answered him very directly. He said, "I know how to beat the drum." And then the monk, this great monk, I hope you can all take him to heart. This monk then says, "Okay, when an enlightened person comes, how do you treat him?" That is, a person who has transcended these things, who is someone who is practicing true passing. "When an enlightened one comes, how do you treat him?" And Hoshan said, "I know how to beat the drum." That's the whole story. I love this story. This is his persistence in bringing form and emptiness together in the activity world, in the Nirmanakaya and the Sambhogakaya, the dream body world, and the Dharmakaya body world, all of it coming together right here in beating the drum, in playing the bell, in cooking the rice, in standing up for Kinhin, in leading Kinhin, in bowing. And this is why we do retreats, actually. This is why we have forms. Because in the forms, the form world allows the true practice to permeate and saturate every form. And because we're human beings who have been well-trained in the relative world, we don't persist in that combination of form and emptiness in all of our activities. And yet, every once in a while, we hit that sweet spot, that tender place where things come together. And we know it, and we taste it, and maybe it lives for a little while in our bodies, and then we forget about it again, and then we keep being reminded, "Remember, remember, remember, don't forget, don't forget, don't forget, this is it." So the little story that's in the background of this is what I wanted to end with today. I find it very moving, actually, because it's partly about the very real danger, the mortal danger of getting caught in either the absolute or the relative. I think we know the dangers of getting caught in the relative, but getting caught in the absolute, this is something that Hoshan knew very well for himself. He was a student of Shui Feng, who was an old man when Hoshan first started studying with him. And when Hoshan was only 20 years old, Shui Feng died. So he went to another teacher named Jie Feng. And Jie Feng was his transmitting teacher and transmitted the Dharma to Hoshan. And Jie Feng was Shui Feng's Dharma heir. If you're getting confused with all these names, so basically, Hoshan's teacher died. And Hoshan went to study with his teacher's Dharma heir and received transmission from this guy, his Dharma heir. And there's a famous story about this second teacher, Jie Feng, the first teacher's Dharma heir, that he went to study with another teacher. He succeeded both Shui Feng and another teacher named Shi Shuang. And with his first teacher, when he received the Dharma from his first teacher, his first teacher made a test for him. So that's all the background. You don't need to know what's going on with these guys anymore, except that here we have a teacher who is checking his students to see who's the person who should succeed me. And sadly, there were two candidates when Shi Shuang died, when this other teacher died. And so the two of them battled it out. The guy we're interested in, Jiafeng, who is Hoshan's teacher, and this other guy whose name we only know as the head monk, which is always an indication in these stories that history passed him by and he never got recorded in any of the histories. So you know that something terrible is going to happen to him. So they had a battle, they had a debate, and Hoshan said, "Our late teacher said you should be completely finished up, emptied away. You should be like cold ashes in the dead tree, like the incense burner on the deserted shrine, like the frozen lake, like a piece of glazed silk." So we hear these beautiful words, and we know, hopefully, where Hoshan is pointing. He is pointing to the world of the absolute. So a response could be, the head monk's response could be, something to reflect that. And he does indeed reflect that. He says, "It means the realm of one color," which is a direct description of the absolute. But there's nothing in that answer that shows anything about the coming together of form and emptiness. He just names the emptiness. So the teacher, Shi Shuang, said, Jiafeng said, "You don't understand our teacher's meaning." And here we have to get inside the heart of the head monk for a moment. The head monk has just been bested by this guy, and he wants to be the head of the monastery. And he is very, very much caught up in thinking he knows better than everybody else. And here's where that can go. He ordered someone to fetch a packet of incense and said, "If I cannot pass away, if I cannot die while this incense is burning, then your words will be proved true." Which is a kind of funny challenge to bring up, because he wants to inherit the monastery, he wants to inherit the temple, the robe and the bowl, and he's saying, "I'm going to show my great understanding by dying." And so he threw the incense into the burner, white smoke arose, and while it was still hanging in the air, the monk died. And Jiafeng, Koshan's teacher, stroked this guy's back and said, "You could die sitting up straight as you have done, but you could never dream of our late teacher's meaning." And he took over the monastery and eventually transmitted the Dharma to Hoshan, who knows how to beat the drum. So here is our challenge on this beautiful winter morning where the sun is coming in the windows, where all of us are sitting up straight and getting lost in our delusions over and over and over again, and swinging to the absolute, "Everything is just this," and then swinging back into, "Oh, I wish I knew, I wish I understood," etc. Coming together, finding the way together, finding true passing, not hearing or nearness separated from each other, but the transcendence of the two, the coming together, the integration of the two in one body. And let's all express our understanding of this right now in this moment by putting our palms together and bowing to each other. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we will have our Dharma dialogue. A reminder that in the world of form, this is being recorded, and so if you don't want what you say recorded, we can turn off the recorder. And let's go around and say our names. I'm Melissa.
Esther.
Jenny.
Ray.
Andrew.
Susan.
Harold.
David.
Todd.
Meredith.
Andy.
Alan.
Tibby.
David.
So, Melissa Roshi, what is your drum?
Well, right now it's just talking to you. Yeah. Every moment, right? We get to play the drum. And sometimes we just play it. And other times we get into, I know how to play the drum. And other times we get into, I have no clue how to play the drum. And then, phew, we hit the sweet spot sometimes too. How about you?
We'll return to the Zendo.
Right. Thank you.
We do tend to complicate things, don't we?
Yeah, for sure. No, I think we live in the world of complication much more than we live in the world of ease. I don't know. I think that's just because we have these big human brains that know how to complicate things. Is that your experience?
Yes. Yes.
And I just got to say, in the realm of the absolute, complicating things is it too. You know, right? And on the other hand.
And just so lovely talk. And you have sort of led us through the brambles. One story nested in another story, and the story about the story about the... quite a lovely presentation of... impossible to understand. And I find myself sort of, okay, beating the drum, and then we're dying with the incense, and then we're quite a lovely muddle you have put us in.
You're welcome.
And with such delight, I guess that's the thing.
Yes.
I'm learning how to beat the drum.
Literally.
I jumped the gun a little bit today. I didn't wait for a bell, and then I had to wait and get back in sync. And I remember playing music with people. Sometimes there's somebody that just like, no, my beat. That, you know, like insists, just play louder at that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Different beat. Yeah. And it just, it's, I don't know, it's, it just doesn't go. It's, it feels better, it feels more cooperative to, okay, I'll wait until I get to your beat.
My brother and I, when we were very young, started learning instruments, and he was learning the trumpet, and I was learning the clarinet, and we would practice at the same time in the same room. And so every day was a competition of who could play louder and stay on beat and not let the other guy get him. But all of these playing instruments, and on the beat and off the beat, and these rhythms, and this competition. You know, interesting in the story, this competition. Who's the one, and who do you trust? And yeah.
And to this day, David plays the clarinet really loud.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Competition and cooperation.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and that, I think that's exactly what the point is. These two points together. You know, about there is no self, and trust yourself. You know, trust your own view. They're kind of competing in a funny way, right? They're, and the outside coming in, and the inside, you know, the trusting the inside, it's really confusing because we have to be able to receive feedback. And we also, yeah, and maybe, you know, the feedback just throws us. I've certainly, that's happened to me many, many times. And then something then arises that isn't me, some clarity. And so they're constantly going back and forth.
We have to listen while we play.
Right, that's the transcendence.
Just that this trust in your own view reminds me of Lin Chi talking about confidence. That as we practice, we have to have confidence. And I loved what you said about that image of there is the learning, I was in the koan, the learning from the outside, and that's important. But this learning, we've been talking about these slogans. If you memorize all 59 slogans, you might pass the test at the end. We have mentioned that, right? That there'll be a written multiple
Nobody's
choice.
Nobody's going to show up.
You might pass that, but they actually won't be useful to you. This is about both hearing this and then saying, what is true from my own heart? What is resonant? And that's the true teaching. That's your teaching. That's just for you, from you, in you. And so important that we're not looking ultimately to understand even what the teacher's saying, but to understand what is this truth, this Dharma that we encounter.
So I am the words hearing and nearness. Stay with me. And I still feel the reverberations of Alan's talk the other day. And the rawness and the transparency or the honesty that was in a teacher. And so for me, something comes up around staying in that place where the hearing and the intimacy is just sort of wobbling back and forth. I mean, the way that these words mean something to me at this moment, and to something about the arising and the passing away. And so when I experience it in teaching or in talking about something, and I notice these places of the woundedness come up, or what happens is my mind will go something like, oh, me, vulnerable, oops. But really, if I can allow it to just be woundedness or humanness that comes and goes, then something happens. And I think also something about the dying, because there is a dying in that moment. And right after Alan talked, something was in my practice around noticing that when there is dying, if I take a close look, there is a lot of life. Like there is new life in my life as I see this dying. So dying is not an absence or something falling away. It usually happens right next to alive fullness, if that's a word. English is not my first language. Excuse me if I'm not reaching an end point in what I'm saying, but that's okay.
I think you're expressing it really well, you know, that movement back and forth and the tenderness that arises in the you use the word wobble. And that really speaks to me.
Like those round things, like the ball with a plate on it, and you can stand on it.
That's how it feels. That's a good description of Zen, I think.
This brings me back to like high school and like the social dynamic that I remember just being entirely predicated upon competition and sort of no restraint and savagery. were just like a block or two away. It's like, how do we allow that, like, emptiness, the teachings to, like, enter into this deeply rooted pattern of God? Because I think it's not going to change unless it changes for the kids. Mm-hmm. How does that reach them when there's so much bombardment of media?
Right.
It's like, I think we're pretty cool. I don't think they think we're as exciting as the flashy colors of scientific. We study manipulation of minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I think so important to see the forces of power at work in the world, there are forces that have a vested interest in us being trained as consumers and us not touching that seeing through your own eyes, and our nieces and children and friends, and the question I hear is what can we do? Those forces are so strong. The first thing that occurs to me, one, is to come and really work on ourselves. Because the biggest problem all of us have is us. And then when we do this work, then when you go to see your nieces, and let's play Candyland. Right? It is and that's how you teach them the Dharma. Right? And knowing it will not be enough, and it will be all that is necessary. You know, so moment by moment, as we enter into our life, as we live our life, not to be talking about Buddhism and other things, but alive in the moment, trusting the heart. There is a transmission, you to your nieces, and as you are present with them, whether they say or acknowledge or not, something happens. Yeah.
And you know, and I think too that along these same lines, I think of the cutthroat game of Candyland. You know, all these kids' games are really mean. You have to, you know, knock people out, get to the end, get the candy. if you don't know Candyland, it's a board game where you roll dice and, you know, move your marker to get to the end, but all kinds of stuff happens on the way. It's like the game of life. All these games are like that, card games and, you know, tag and all the games kids play. Because I really believe that human beings, well, you used a very strong word, I can't remember what it is now, but something, you know, about violence, savagery. You know, that we are savages. Very thinly disguised as civilized people. And, you know, if anybody could read all of our minds all through Zazen, there'd be proof, right? There's all kinds of crap going on in here. So I think that there's something about coming to the realization internally that I must work with this savagery. That we can't say to somebody else. You know, I just, as you were speaking, I had this fantasy of going to the White House and saying, "So, President Trump, I'd like to talk to you about Zen." He wouldn't want to know anything about Zen. This is my fantasy of him. I've never met him. But, you know, people are ready when they're ready. And so what David said, the real teaching is exactly that. Playing Candyland is the teaching. You know, not. Hey, you want to learn how to meditate, kid? And just doing what we're doing and doing it sincerely, I think it resonates and people get drawn into this practice and into this temple, and it's very surprising. And people come thinking, "Ooh, Zen, so cool." Well, not as much as they used to years ago, because Zen was really cool when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s. You know, but then it got out of coolness. But, you know, it's cool for a little bit and then it isn't. Because we're actually asking people to give up their lives. And what I mean by that is give up the savagery. And I don't think everybody's ready. People are ready for that when they're ready for it, I guess. And it's not for everybody. Some people can live their lives without these teachings. And yet, you know, I have a wish. Which is why I keep gabbing on. Instead of just practicing. Thanks.
Going back to the actual drumming for a moment, you know, whether as we were talking about in the koan or as we're talking about doing right here, it strikes me as maybe he played the drum or as we play the drum here and try to do it right, not speed up or slow down in the wrong place, not to play overbearingly loud or too faint. Mm-hmm. And we try to keep that up, yet we talk about each moment being a new world, mm-hmm. as it is. So maybe in the story he was talking about how to, again, strike that balance you're talking about between the absolute and the relative, mm-hmm. hold on to what was happening, yet here we are, you as well.
Yeah. Well, I love that. And all of the roles in Sesshin are about this. Even if we could afford to have other people do all the work is not what this is about, because it is about actualizing this. So when you're doing the Mokugyo, you can't go, "Oh, that was great." Because Ray will be... And we all will. But yet, as you're saying, with each one, to have each one be complete, each strike of the Mokugyo is the complete expression of your love. Your whole life led, boom. But it's not separate. It's boom, 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 boom. It's, walking. Each step is the fulfillment of all of life. Wonderful to see this playing that way. And I think Zen in particular emphasizes this, both together. As mm-hmm. Melissa said, that, so strong, one without the other, you miss the joy. So we're not heading into that realm where it's all one, but seeing that that realm is right here, and then the beauty and the possibility of this flashing, ephemeral world coming and going is mind blowing. Yeah, yeah, and we can taste that. Yeah, all of us. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, again.
I often think of these at these coming and going sessions. It is usually at the end. There's the monk. It's the story of the monk who's seeking what to do with life and with everything that's going on. And he goes and sees the teacher, and the teacher says, "Have you eaten?" yes, yes, but the world's all falling apart, and what to do? And the teacher says, "Wash your bowl." Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, yes. So, what you do? First things first, you be, you wash your bowl, and this is what we do here. You wash your bowl. You take care of the next thing. It's like, to me, washing your bowl is also like, my nieces, my cousins, they're all caught in this thing. What do I do? Play a game with them. Right?
Yeah.
What the moment calls for, the meaning of it, is the answer. That's it.
It is, isn't it?
It's just so completely it. I know how to beat the drum. I know how to wash the bowl.
Yes.
I know how to play the game.
Yeah, that's it.
Right. I think that's pretty, and that's what Andy was pointing to, very much directly.
Yeah.
And we're really kind of all dancing around this same thing.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Ray. Ellen, did you have your hand up?
No.
Okay. Not anymore. Did you say that? Okay. Yeah.
So I'm super competitive. I'm crazy competitive. And sometimes it's really fun. There's energy in it. I love it. Mm-hmm. This whole talk is reminding me of a little story that Charlotte Schoeffelbeck tells in one of her books, Every Day Zen, probably something mm-hmm. like that, Nothing Special. Mm-hmm. And she talks about going to the market, and there are these two men who sell tomatoes, and they're both in the market, and they're like, my tomatoes are the best, my tomatoes are the best, the point I think she was making is that there's a sense of play about it, you know. And then after they're done with the market, they go and they have a little, you know, coffee together, and they joke about, you know, selling at the market. It reminded me of the movie Elf, where the elf, he goes, I love the whole movie, but one of the great scenes is when he takes his new girlfriend that he's dating to this coffee shop, and he blindfolds her, and he takes her in, and he's like, try this. And so she like, there's coffee in front of her, and she takes a sip, and she's like, what is this? And he's like, it's the world's greatest coffee. It says right on this sign, it's the world's greatest coffee. And so, I don't know, I think there's a way to do this that's fun. My daughter, she rows crew for Williams College, and one of the sayings that she learned from her high school coach was, nothing goes wrong on race day.
Mm.
And they lose. I mean, she loses. I mean, she loves to win, but they also lose. But the saying is, nothing goes wrong on race day.
Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful, again, integration of the form and emptiness world. You know, to embrace the competitiveness and nothing went wrong. Yeah.
So that's my aspiration. Most of the time I'm just...
But I'm so glad you mentioned the energy of competition, because I think it's really, really true, and it's part of the, you know, the savagery of human beings is not necessarily a negative thing, right? There's a book that I'm really in love with that I've been studying for a talk I'm supposed to give called A Terrible Love of War. It's by a Jungian analyst. Right, that human beings, we like to clash. We like to do it. We get something out of it. And you see these two Zen people in the story. You know, the I'll show you. I'm gonna show how powerful I am by dying. It's like, oh no, no. But that's so human. And this is like more than 1,000 years ago, human beings still doing this kind of thing. It's kind of humbling. I think we have to own the energy. It's like what there's an earlier thing in the Lojong teachings about, that we've kind of talked about how anger naturally transforms into wisdom. Because the energy itself of anger, of no, 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 oh, 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 it becomes bigger and cuts. This is how we cut through delusion. You have to actually cut through delusion. You can't just go, okay, delusion, you have to go sometimes. No. Oh. You can't get to the oh without the no. And I just have to say, I can't remember the exact quote, maybe David will remember, but for many years we used to go to to North Wales to teach a retreat, and it's this little seaside village that we love to hang out in. It's totally touristy now, but there's a fish and chips place that says, possibly the best fish and chips. Is that what it is? or perhaps. It's either, it's perhaps the best. And I remember seeing the signs. Oh man, you wouldn't get away with that in America. Right? But it's the same, you know, that's the British way of saying we are the best. So, you know, come on. But possibly the best fish and chips.
I love that. But a great church sign that I saw once that, I don't know, they nailed it. It was the Vineyard, a pretty good church.
Yeah, right. A pretty good church. And with that, maybe. this is a pretty good Dharma time.
Let's do some pretty good zazen.
Okay.